We know that light pollution makes it harder to see the stars, but those of us who aren't astronomers or stargazers might not know that it also causes health problems and wastes billions of dollars in electricity every year. J. Kelly Beatty is the award-winning senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. On November 4th, he'll give a talk as part of the Kalamazoo Astronomical Society's 80th anniversary celebration. And he's here with me on Skype. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, hello.
Those of us who are not stargazers, you know, may not understand why we should pay attention to this problem. So, you know, convince us.
Really, the loss of starry night skies is a societal problem. You know, it's a quality of life issue. You touched on the stargazers and the astronomers, and I think there's a little of that in all of us, really. I'm sure those of us who've had the chance to go outside under a pitch dark sky and see the Milky Way arcing overhead, or a lovely crescent moon, or, you know, all those stars out there, are just sort of compelled to think big thoughts about where we came from, what our place in the universe is, what does it all mean. And so the fact that we have been robbed of that right to see a dark sky is really sad, and it's hurting us in a kind of sense of civilization and a sense of self.
Not only that, but we're not sleeping as well because of this problem. Can you kind of explain that aspect?
So our bodies, when we're asleep, create a compound called melatonin. It's created by a little gland in the brain called the pineal gland. And that gland only secretes melatonin when it's dark outside. In fact, a little more than a decade ago, research showed that there's a sensor in the eye that has nothing to do with vision. It's essentially a trigger, an on-off switch, if you will, for the pineal gland that tells it that it's dark, so it should make melatonin. Now, we don't fully understand melatonin's role in our body's health, but studies have shown that melatonin can suppress the growth of cancer tumors in mice. And so there's some thought that there's a link between the degree to which we have melatonin in our system and the corresponding degree that we can suppress or diminish cancers in our system. This was just a theory until like the late 1980s, a researcher named Richard Stevens put this to a test, and he found that statistically, those who work night shifts, you know, hospital nurses or factory workers, had a significantly higher risk for developing breast cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. And it was a strong enough link that the International Agency for Cancer Research has declared night shift work to be a probable carcinogen. You know, so people who've done this for a very long time are literally at higher risk for developing cancer. Now, the important point to make here is that the kind of light that you're exposed to under, you know, on the floor of a factory or in a hospital ward at night is far higher than most of us are when we're trying to get to sleep at night, or when there's, you know, a streetlight coming into our window. But the point of all this research is that it disrupts the circadian cycle, it disrupts the production of melatonin in our system, and as I mentioned, separately, in lab studies with rats, it's been shown that melatonin can suppress the growth of cancer. So it's, you know, a lot of it in terms of human health is circumstantial. It's certainly the case that a lack of melatonin in our system, you know, like when we take a red-eye flight or we're up late, and we can't produce that melatonin, we end up feeling cranky and fatigued. And so there's a general sense that melatonin is influential in our overall immune system. And so we want to get as much melatonin as we can. And darkness is key to that production, just in terms of a natural day-night cycle.
In an article that you wrote for the Sun Journal, I believe that was in Maine, specifically you said that most lights are not aimed at the ground, that they're aimed other places, you know, sometimes just in the case of businesses, sort of into the atmosphere. You know, why do we do this, and what could we do to stop these misdirected lights?
You know, I won't name any names, but a lot of businesses, especially those that are open at night, use strong lighting to draw customers in. You know, service stations, fast food establishments are all trying to get your attention, And so often they create a lot of lighting that is indiscriminate. It goes well beyond the needs for just, pumping gas or whatever. It's also been the case that tens of millions of streetlights that were installed in the 1950s and 60s have a kind of glass bottom to them, shaped like a salad bowl, if you can imagine that. And the light bulb for those streetlights casts light mostly on the ground, but some of it goes up into the sky. Or you can imagine a convenience store, near you that's trying to illuminate its parking lot by slapping lighting fixtures, we call them wall packs, on the side of the building and having them shine sideways into the parking lot. Well, a lot of that light ends up going up instead of down. So all these reasons are wasteful. Now, there's some good news in that the lighting industry, in response to the needs of businesses and consumers, has started designing a lot of lighting that is more efficient. If you go to any new development, a business park or something like that, and look at the lighting, you'll see that they've been designed to shine the light straight down and not up. And the reasons for that have really very little to do with being environmentally aware. It's all about the economics. If you can put all of the light generated on the ground, you don't need to generate as much light. You use a lower wattage bulb, you save electricity.
It's funny to think about things like streetlights. A lot of us think that streetlights are, if we didn't have them, we might more likely run into a deer. But you say that there are actually ways that this lighting can hinder our driving.
Yeah, so if the streetlight is designed poorly and it shines in your eyes, it creates glare. And that glare inhibits your ability to see well at night. And let me draw this example. You're driving alone at night on a dark country road, and your headlights are shining out in front of you. You know that your eyes kind of get adapted to the dark. Your pupils dilate, and you can see better when it's dark after your eyes have been exposed to the darkness a while. If another car is coming at you with its high beams on, or even if not, your pupils constrict, and so not enough light gets into your eye to see in those dark shadows along the side of the road, and you're momentarily kind of hindered from seeing as well until that car passes. Same with streetlights. If a streetlight is designed poorly, or if you're passing a used car lot with strong lighting on it, you're often unable to see as well as you otherwise might be. Now, there's definitely a place for streetlights. If you talk to a lighting designer, they'll say, we want to put lights where there are what's called conflict zones at intersections, or where you've got a crosswalk where people are crossing the road and you want to be able to see them far, far ahead of when your headlights would otherwise show you these people in the crosswalk. So it's not to say that there's no place for streetlights, but we want to design them with the least amount of glare possible. And that generally means designing them so that all of their light goes down and not out.
The International Dark Sky Association says that the United States wastes more than $3 billion worth of energy a year. But also, and this is something that I didn't consider before this interview, these lights also release 21 million tons of carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas associated with climate change.
Yeah, the streetlights themselves don't do that, but the power plants that are needed to generate that much electricity are. It's an odd thing about power plants. They like to run 24/7. And so if you think back to the post-World War II years, power plants were looking for a way to use the electricity that they generated at night when a lot of people weren't using very much electricity. And so companies like Westinghouse and General Electric made it very attractive for towns and cities to install lots and lots, millions of streetlights as a way to use this sort of excess electricity at night. And in a very real sense, the vast networks of streetlights that we have are in part a legacy of that time. A lot of those streetlights go back to that time.
There are actually some articles that came out saying that LEDs are brighter. And thus, as we use more of them for things like streetlights, we're actually contributing to more light pollution. So what's your thought on this?
Yeah, so your eye at night uses different sensors than we do during the daytime. You know, just looking around during the daytime, we use what are called cones in our eyes. At night, it switches over to a black and white system that's very sensitive to light called rods. And the rods are extremely sensitive to blue light, such that even with the two lights emitting the same amount of light coming out of them, the same number of photons, the one with the bluish light will seem much brighter, much harsher. And so one of the problems with LEDs is they're most efficient when they emit the bluest light. And so if you're a municipal planner and you're trying to put streetlights on your roads and you're trying to get the, you know, the best efficiency and the most light for the dollar, you would be biased toward getting these blue rich LEDs. The problem is people don't like them. It's been shown all over the country that they seem harsh. They seem bright. It gives kind of an alien landscape. And we're getting the International Dark Sky Association, which you mentioned, and which I hope we can talk a little more about, has recommended that any outdoor LED have a color temperature of no higher than 3000 Kelvin. And that's a color temperature that we would call soft white or warm white. And it's actually quite pleasant to the eye. And in particular, it doesn't have as much of this blue component to it. And why is that important? Turns out that this blue light is the highest energy, and it's the most disruptive in terms of the nighttime environment, animals. It's also the blue light is most easily scattered in the atmosphere, and it creates the most amount of light pollution. So it's something I could just do without in my nighttime environment, and the IDA is recommending in that direction.
Now, you know, a lot of the things that we've talked about related to light pollution have been businesses, have been governments. What can we, you know, the average person do to help decrease light pollution?
Yeah, so you can work even locally. I'll give an example. Let's say you're just a homeowner by yourself and you've got a security light out in the back that's on from dusk to dawn all night, every night. Well, first of all, that's using a lot of electricity. What I would recommend for an individual is that consider switching that light to one that's on a motion sensor so that the light only comes on when there's something in your yard that's disturbing, you know, that's within range. Just doing that alone, you can, the money that you would save in electricity would pay for that motion sensor within the first 6 months. Broadening out, in your neighborhoods, there are always, when a new business is coming in, that business will come before the planning board of your local town and have to pass all kinds of regulations, you know, plumbing and heating and safety, the size of parking lots, all kinds of stuff, the strength of the building. Ask your local planning board if they'd consider working on a set of lighting requirements that would minimize the amount of light pollution that these new businesses create. This is especially true if that business happens to be located near a residential area. And then more broadly, your town can create lighting bylaws that regulate the amount of light and save energy. Maybe your town itself is in the process of switching over to LEDs for streetlights. Get involved in that process, find out what's going on, and argue for streetlights that are not too bright, that are not too blue, and that maybe have controls on them that will switch them off in the wee hours of the morning, say from midnight to 5 a.m., when they're not needed as much.
Well, J. Kelly Beatty, senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. And I just want to mention in closing, if they want more, your listeners want more information, they can go to the IDA's website, which is darksky.org. Very easy to see. And there's all kinds of resources available there for them.
All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.